episode of the Author Conversations podcast. I'm your host, Jenny, and I'm here with my co-host, Johnny.
Hey.
Now, if you listen to the last two episodes on the Texas Chicken Ranch, I want to go ahead and let you know that we will be shifting gears this episode with a book that is a little more somber. Today, we're discussing Food, Hope, and Resilience, Authentic Recipes and Remarkable Stories from Holocaust Survivors by June Hirsch. Johnny, do you want to go ahead and read about the author and a little book blurb for us?
Sure. I'll start with the book blurb since it's just right here on the back of the book, easier to get to. This vital collection of survivor stories uplifts and inspires alongside recipes that nourish your soul. So basically, it's a history cookbook, really. Read about daring partisans who fought in the woods, hidden children who sought comfort from strangers, and those who endured unimaginable internment. For Holocaust survivors, food was a way to connect their lives before the war with the homes they created after. Their kitchens were filled with aromas of familiar foods like chicken soup and brisket, while unfamiliar delights they adopted, like arroz con pollo, which is chicken.
Yes.
Because I like going to the Mexican restaurant house. And noche became part of their repertoire. These are the recipes they share with you. Culinary icons such as Michael Solomonov, Jonathan Waxman, Ina Garten, and more contribute their own recipes as tribute to the remarkable survivor community. Author Jane Hirsch gives readers a taste of history and a life-affirming message that honors the legacy of Holocaust survivors. And a little bit about the author. June Hirsch grew up in New Rochelle, New York. She graduated magna cum laude from the University of Pennsylvania with a degree in elementary education. She holds a master's degree in gifted and talented education and taught third and fourth grade before joining her family's lighting business. Yeah, I would ditch teaching third and fourth graders to go into another business too.
Yeah,
I don't blame her on that one. When her family sold the company in 2004, June's sister remarked, "We did well, now let's do good." That's when June embarked on her food writing career, penning cookbooks with a charitable flavor. She has authored five books with a focus on the Holocaust, Jewish food, and food history, all of which have generated proceeds for charitable organizations. Proceeds from the sale of this book will benefit those committed to teaching the lessons of the Holocaust. June was a featured guest on QVC's In the Kitchen with David, has given hundreds of book talks in connection with her published works, and writes extensively for food blogs and magazines. She is a member of the New York chapter of Les Dames d'Escoffier, probably, I'm guessing that's how you say it, a philanthropic organization of female leaders in the food, wine, and beverage industry, and serves on the advisory board of the Catskills Borscht Belt Museum. When not cooking or writing, June enjoys traveling, playing with her dog Malamar, and most of all, being called Nana by Henry, Daisy, and Aria. She resides in Bedford, New York, with her husband of 47 years to provide feedback, inquire about speaking engagements, or just to chat. Email junehirsch@gmail.com. That's junehirsch@gmail.com. I take a breath in the middle of that because the bio is basically a book in and of itself. Yeah. She's very accomplished.
So, fun story about the Dames d'Escoffier. We actually just published another book kind of revolving around that as well, another cookbook.
Of course we did.
Yeah, it's actually a good one. It was just listed in Sevier Magazine's best cookbooks this year or for the holidays. One of those.
What lists. Do we not have a book on?
Nothing. That's the goal.
Yeah, everything's going to be covered. And then more things will happen, and we'll cover those things
exactly.
Again.
That's how you keep going.
I mean, we're kind of living through history all the time right now. Let's take a break from it.
So. So the foreword of the book is written by Daniel Boulud. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. He's an award-winning chef and restaurateur. Daniel owns several restaurants around the world. His most well-known restaurant is called Daniel. I'm not going to comment on that. But he also has a nonprofit to feed emergency service workers. But I want to read a bit of the foreword just because it spoke to me. Food is a vital component to our lives. Our memories of food connect us to family, heritage, and each other. And that's so true. Do you have any recipes that just like bring back memories for you, Johnny?
Yeah, a lot. So we talked about Nanny. She went to go see the best little whorehouse in Texas last week, or 2 weeks ago.
Right.
She would make not chicken and dumplings, but potatoes and dumplings. And I don't know how she got so much flavor into it, but it was incredible. And her vegetable soup and cornbread were always really good. And she made a multi-layer, not like three, but like those little bitty layers cakes. And then she made her own chocolate icing to put on top of it. And it was incredible. I remember my mom's parents, Mama and Pawpaw, like if you stayed with them every morning, you were going to have sausage, bacon, country ham, sausage gravy, biscuits, and eggs. And you would eat a whole lot and feel like you were going to throw up from eating so much, and they still tried to get you to eat more.
So they made, like, TV breakfasts for you.
Yeah.
Nice.
I think if we were to talk about my dad's favorite thing, which is really weird, is probably orange salad, which is just, like, Cool Whip. There's, like, canned Maldives or whatever oranges and some other stuff. I'm just like, this is, what?
So. That's such a, like, American thing. It's a salad. But it's not.
No, it's not. I guess it came about like back in the 80s or 70s when they did stuff like that. So, what about you?
I've got a few as well. So my dad has a famous quote unquote cornbread.
Not a chili, but a cornbread.
Corn pudding recipe. And it just kind of always brings me back. And then my great grandmother. She used to make bread for every holiday, and she said that she was going to take this recipe to the grave, and she did. So we no longer get to eat it, but yeah, it's kind of sad because that was always kind of a flavor of, you know, the holidays for us. But my favorite recipe or thing that was, it only happened once, but it brings back such a strong memory, is rum cake.
All right, yeah, I like that.
When I was 13, my aunts brought rum cake to Christmas. And I just remember, like, being kind of the fat kid that I am. I was like, I obviously want to eat cake.
Chub loves the grubs. I was the same way.
And so, you know, I went to go grab a cake, and my aunt was like, well, it is rum cake. And my dad, like, he always looked at my aunts in this way because they were kind of like my fun single party aunts. And he would always give them this look when it came to me of like, why are you involving my daughter in this? And so, you know, my aunt was like, oh, but it's cake. You know, the rum is cooked out of it. It's perfectly fine. It was not cooked out of it. It was a rum cake.
So your aunts got you drunk for the holidays?
They sure did.
Did you get hungover or did they notice you were just buzzed?
I mean, so I think I only took one bite and then was completely grossed out by it, which... Mm. Everybody had a good laugh over.
That's how it was with my first taste of beer. Now I love it. So
yeah, maybe I should go back to rum cake.
When you reminded me, when you were talking about not having your grandma's recipe anymore, like that's the reason why like I begged and pleaded with Pawpaw to give me his barbecue sauce recipe, and that's why I have it framed in the kitchen.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Smart. All right. So this book is broken up into the different countries that were affected by the Holocaust. And it starts with, well, it goes into Poland, Germany and Austria, Belgium and France, Hungary and Czechoslovakia, which is actually no longer one country, but it's now Slovakia and Czechia, I just learned. I was actually there when they originally separated, which is really interesting. I remember that happening.
Because you're a military brat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We lived in Germany at the time. And then it's Romania, Russia, and the Ukraine, and Greece. So we'll start with Poland. Poland is the largest collection in the book. The German invasion of Poland is kind of what triggered World War II, but Polish recipes kind of represent what many of the iconic Jewish recipes we know are. So the story that we're going to talk about is Frania and Mike Falowicz.
That sounds good to me.
If you haven't noticed already, I am terrible with names and pronunciations. So theirs is actually a really fun, beautiful love story, despite their, you know, obviously terrible circumstances. They were forced into the ghetto, and Mike always kind of had a soft spot for Frania, so he would sneak food in for her. And then after they were liberated, they decided to be married. And Mike wanted to sew something for Frania for the wedding. So he sewed her a pair of pants using military-issue blankets, for which she was later arrested because they claimed she had stolen them. And then she wore a veil made of medical gauze. It's such a beautiful story of love pulling through no matter what.
That's exactly what happens. I don't know how you survive this. But they go on to live normal lives. Like right. Some of the people in here, I'm just like, I can't do that.
Right. You
know, I would be so pissed off. So.
Pissed off and sad. Apparently her gauze veil, though, was used several more times for other people's weddings, which is kind of nice.
I guess. I was thinking, like, maybe they, like, because he could sew, mm-hmm. did he sew more gauze together to make it a true veil? Kind of, like, I wish we would have had a picture of it to look at. I'm sure it's, like, long gone by now, though, because it was gauze.
Right, so. Right. Doesn't, not really made to last.
No. So that's the whole, I mean, think about it. There was a, I think it was 1936, Jenny. And, 1936. So even after Poland's invaded, 3 years later, Germany hosts the Olympics in Berlin. Which is some crazy BS, if you ask me about it. I mean, there was all this appeasement trying, and that's why you got to stand up to a bully. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Violence, I know that whole, violence is not the answer. Well, sometimes if you punch a bully in the nose, they stop.
Right.
So, but there's this book by this author, Andy Andrews, and he talks about how do you kill 11 million people. And it's, you just lie to them.
Yep.
You say, we're putting you over here in this ghetto. Like in Warsaw and think places mm-hmm. like that for your protection because so many people don't like you. Well, why do they not like you? It's because of your crap you're pulling, you know?
Right.
Hey, we're going to send you over to this area instead to protect you.
Right.
That's why, I mean, you can't think about the number of people they put on cattle cars to go to these places under the guise of we're protecting you. It's not until later the Jewish family start to realize, hey, we're being rounded up.
Right.
And it's too late then because you've already given all this over.
Yeah.
So it's, no, that came to me while I was reading this book, remembering that book.
Yeah. I actually remember, similarly, on the other side of the spectrum, there's a photograph of Nazis working at one of the camps. I don't remember which camp it was. They're not really working. They're posing for the photo, but they're laughing. They're having a great time. And that, I think someone in that photograph later commented on it and, you know, said, like, we had no idea. You know, we were also lied to. We thought that we were actually helping these people and saving them. And that's crazy to me, too, to think about the fact that, like, they, you know, everybody was tricked in this situation.
I mean,
after a while, obviously, you realize what you guys are doing.
Yeah. I mean, there's things going on in the world right now where, because you and I study history, and it's not, when you study history, it's not because history is going to repeat. Because history may repeat itself, it's because it's going to. So right. It's almost like you got a crystal freaking ball in your hand.
Right.
And you can see what happened. There's stuff going on all over the world where people are getting lied to for safety.
Right.
They're getting lied to because, hey, we're here to protect you.
Right.
And people just aren't waking up to it. So, maybe a book like this will help them.
Yeah. I have hopes of, you know, while social media, I think, sometimes is the downfall of society, I also think that it's nice because people can actually see what's happening now. Like, there's so much visibility.
You know, a lot of independent journalists get a bad rap, but a lot of times they're just uploading raw footage
mm-hmm.
and saying, here, make your decision.
Right.
But, I mean, that's the way journalism was supposed to be.
It should be, yeah. Should be completely unbiased.
You know, freedom of the press. I don't want anybody, I don't want a statist media, obviously. Right. I don't want anybody to say what can and can't be published.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of times I'll just call it out, Fox News, MSNBC, CNN,
mm-hmm.
Newsmax, whatever. They kind of trample over that for the press. So.
Yeah. It's all about the ratings now.
Oh, yeah. It's shock value stuff is all you get. So.
Yep.
And it's like depressing. I took like a week off from watching the news and it was like one of the best weeks of my life.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. We'll get back to it.
All right. Hopping back in. Like I said, this is going to be a more somber episode.
In case you couldn't tell already.
So next we're moving over to Germany and Austria, which is actually fun because I am going to Germany and Austria soon for vacation. So we know, obviously, Germany. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the German occupation. It's kind of what started the whole thing. And the crazy thing is how Germans felt safe during this time because they were the ones occupying, right? Mm. So the Jews in Germany felt like they were exempt from what was happening. And then 69% of the German Jews and 35% of the Austrian Jews ended up being killed in the war. That's a huge percentage.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to put that into percentage of, like, how many that would be equal, like, if you did it per capita, we could be killed a day, it's mind-blowing.
Right.
In that way.
But I didn't know the food aspect of Germany is super interesting. I never considered the geography to have such a big influence on them. They have the flavorful blending from both Western and Eastern European cultures. Mm-hmm. So they have those, like, hearty and warm recipes from their Eastern European influences, but then they're more like sophisticated from kind of that Western French influence. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I was trying to think about where Wiener Schnitzel and pretzels might come from. And I mean, most of that's Austria, though. Like,
yeah.
So I guess that's Eastern European.
I mean, both Germany and Austria are kind of in the middle.
Yeah, you're right.
Because we're going there, we've been looking at the map because we have, like, the scratch-off maps mm-hmm. for countries we visit. And my husband and I have...
Ooh, I got bunny.
We have, like, separate maps to compare. And Austria is it's a tiny little country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I have ancestry from there, so I would like go there one day.
Yeah.
But I also feel like if I want to go around the world, I'll just go to the World Showcase. Because I'm that kind of person, you know? Because I don't like long, friendly rides. Yeah. If I don't go, I won't know.
Just go to Epcot.
Yeah.
All right. So, from Germany, we are looking at the story of Irma and Martin Reich. So, Irma used to say, food is my life, and I feel that in my bones, probably for very different reasons, because for them, food was life. It kept them alive. And for me, food is just joy. But Irma, and a lot of these stories kind of have a similar theme of, like, how it was basically sheer luck that they survived this. So she was lucky enough to be transported to England when she was a kid, and then was spared from the war because she was in England. But the bombings in England got a little too much for her, so she ended up moving to South America with her brother, who was already there.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike her husband Martin, who had to endure 4 different internment camps before he made his way to America.
Can you imagine that? I mean, every time you go to one, you're wondering if is this going to be it? Is this my last place I'm being sent to?
Right. And then you just move to America and live a normal life.
Yeah. You try. I mean, I don't think you ever genuinely live a normal life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As normal as you can.
Right.
And you try to make, you try to make it as normal and happy for your kids, but also talk to them about what happened.
Right. So next up in the book is Belgium and France. And while Belgium put up a fight, France acted as a quote unquote neutral territory, but the reality was they weren't neutral. Germany and the Nazis came and occupied France just the same as they did Belgium, with the exception being that France signed a treaty with them, allowing them to come in. So even though they claimed to be neutral, they were obviously an ally in the wrong direction.
The Axis powers.
Yep. And what I thought was interesting was that most of the Jews taken to Auschwitz from Belgium were actually Polish citizens who had, or from other countries who had fled to Belgium for safety. And so that's sad.
I feel like you get as far away from there as you can.
Yeah. Like leave
Europe. I mean, I don't know if you can at that point in time. I wasn't in their shoes. I was just thinking, you know, you gotta
get on a boat.
Get on a boat, or, you know, well, there's not really a lot of planes you can do.
Right.
But, yeah, get on a boat, do whatever you got to do. I mean, I know there's stories of people selling whatever they had to get out to buy tickets.
So. Yeah. I think I even read a couple of stories in this book about how people ended up fleeing to the Middle East instead.
Yeah.
You could take a train over to, you know, Israel or...
Yeah, they went to Israel, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's aggravating to think about, too. And do you have something to continue with?
No, go ahead.
So I was thinking about, you know, we were talking about how the, you know, Jews in different parts of the area thought they were safe. And I was reading about, and they talk about a little bit in the book, but they don't really go into detail about what it was at the Kristallnacht, which is basically, so there was this German higher up who was killed by a Polish Jew. And which I kind of feel like that was a setup too. It's just my conspiracy mind. But no matter what happened was, all the Jews got the blame for it. And it was Kristallnacht because of all the glass and things left on the ground and alleyways, the streets the next day, because of where German citizens, not just German military, but citizens were coming in, busting up glass of Jewish homes, businesses, synagogues. And basically, that's what kind of when that big roundup starts. So, I mean, when you see something like that, and then you also read where people were like, well, you know, we've heard before that they're coming for us, but that might not be tonight.
Right.
And then thankfully, you know, one of the spouses, I believe the wife in that situation, got her family out to another place.
Mm-hmm.
But then the mom and dad ended up getting captured.
Right.
And taken to the camp. So, I mean, this was like, well, I feel like this was always in Hitler's mind, Himmler's mind. And this was just the next step in that process, that Kristallnacht was. They're always, you know, seem to have this escalating plan.
Right.
Like I said, with the, hey, we're doing this to protect you.
Yeah.
That's how you kill 11 million people, by saying that. So it was always like an escalating plan to his what? You know, final solution.
Right.
That's what they called it. So.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just thought I would bring up Kristallnacht. And that was also, the weird thing is, and one reason I think that's a conspiracy and why it was planned out, the 2 days after the shooting, like the Kristallnacht, after that Nazi official was killed, and then Kristallnacht happens, it's also on the anniversary of the beer hall push, which is basically where, you know, the Nazi parties come to power and they march in the streets. And then Hitler would repeat that when he came to power, when the Nazi party came to power, every year to celebrate that. So the fact that it coincides with that date, I think, is a red flag that gets sent up to you.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just thought I would bring that up.
Yeah. So you kind of talked about it a little bit, but we're the story of Cecil and Simon. So Simon, again, sheer luck.
Yeah.
He was saved because his mother's dentist had a client who was a police officer at the time and had told them that that impending roundup was happening. So then she went home and told her husband, like, we should probably hide. And her husband didn't believe her because, again, it's like, well, yeah, there's always going to be an impending roundup happening. But they did take their family to their cleaning lady's house and hid, and then were able to escape the roundup. The parents were later captured, like you said, but he survived it. And then his wife, Cecil, same sheer luck. She was at home, and her friend came over and asked her if she wanted to come to a singing lesson with her. And I guess the Jews at the time were not allowed to take any classes. And so the only way she was allowed to attend is,
and they would lie about being Christians in school.
And so she attended with her friend. And while she was at that singing lesson, her parents were rounded up. So it's crazy.
Then that is just sheer luck.
Mm-hmm. To me. Or it's the grace of God, you know, if that's what you believe in.
Well, but. So, I mean, I know there's a lot of people who are like, who believe, not like I have faith too. I'm a Christian. But sometimes things are just luck.
Yeah.
When they were like, well, this is part of God's plan, and when something bad happens, well, God did this for a reason. I'm like, you know?
Yeah.
People don't want to hear that.
Right.
In the moment, especially.
Yeah. So. Especially in that moment of trauma, or related to that moment of trauma.
Now, I know there are bad things that happen, that good came from it.
Right.
And this ain't it.
Right.
Because we still haven't learned from it.
Yeah.
So.
True.
You got some people that deny it happened.
That's the crazy part to me. So you have, like, literal survivors telling their stories, and people are telling them that it's fake.
They're f***ing idiots. I'll bleep that out so we don't get that, but that's my opinion on it.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. So the next chapter is... Yeah, it is. Sorry. Hungary and Czechoslovakia, which my brain kind of froze there for a second, so sorry. But Hungary was a late addition to the war, but once war arrived, it was swift and brutal. More than 500,000 Hungarian Jews were deported and murdered. 500,000. For the record, there are about 10 million people living there now. So 9.71 million, I think, is the count that I had. So obviously we have to account for the fact that population has grown.
Yeah.
But 500,000 is still, that's a huge
number. You put in today's numbers.
I mean. Right, exactly. I didn't do the translation of numbers to see what that would look like today. But it's a lot. I also did not know that Hungary is where paprika is from. I'm sure a lot of people knew that. I didn't know that.
I didn't know until the other day that it was just, or a couple months ago, that it was just crushed red pepper.
Is it really?
But it tastes different, and right. It's good, but that was kind of disappointing. I was hoping it was something more exotic, I guess. I don't know.
So because of that, this region has big flavors. But because it's landlocked, there's not much in the way of fish. So it's a lot of like meat and hearty stews.
Yeah.
So from this region, we are going to talk about George and Ethel Feuerstein. I don't know why, but I really like the name Ethel. It's such an old lady name.
Yeah.
Like Gertrude.
Gertie.
Yeah.
My nanny had a neighbor named Moselle. I've never heard anybody else having that name.
Moselle?
Moselle.
M-O-S-E-L?
M-O-Z-E-L-L-E.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to start bringing some of these names back.
I don't. I mean, it's going to be weird when there's, like, kids who are like, yeah, this is my grandpa Hayden and his brother Hayden and Jaden. You know what I mean?
Right. So. So back to George and Ethel. George was sent to camp, but because he was a barber, he was actually given the job of cutting hair for the SS soldiers, which I think eventually saved him. I think because he had a useful skill that kind of kept him around. And then Ethel's story is equally crazy. She was a seamstress. Her and her family were sent to camp, and when they were standing in line and the soldiers were pointing out, like, you get to go in this line, which is the line of old and sick people who die, or you get to go in this line, which is the people who...
useful to us.
Yeah, can live. They pointed at her mother to go into the death line, and her mother said in German that she was healthy and could work. So they were like, all right, fine, you can go in the worker line. And then her sister, years before, had fallen in love with a man, but they fell out of connection, and she ended up finding him in the camp. And while he didn't recognize her, he recognized her voice, but at the time he was engaged to another woman who apparently had some sway in the camp. And so she was able to kind of keep an eye on them. And I don't actually know if he was Jewish or not, or if he was one of the soldiers. I don't think it really says that.
I just assumed he was Jewish.
Yeah, I did too. But I don't know how his fiance would have that much sway. But she kind of kept them safe.
Yes, it depends on the job she had.
True, true. And then when they were sent into the woods, obviously to be killed, soldiers on motorcycles liberated them. So then from there, she spent time in the Swedish hospital where she met a woman from her hometown that she also knew from the camp.
Hold just a second. Can you imagine that you're on your way? You think that's going to be it? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you got American GIs rolling through on like modern day horses.
Right.
You know, like these motorcycles, just complete badassery coming in.
Yeah.
To me, that would be... I feel like I would probably fall down crying if I saw that, like if you're about to die, those around you are about to die, and then all of a sudden you hear, but lots more coming.
Yeah.
That would just be an incredible, I don't know if that's ever been in a movie or not, but it should be.
Yeah. That's gotta be an incredible feeling. But at the same time, like, I think that it would be such chaos too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's probably shooting from all sides. You don't really know what's going on until
hit the deck.
Yeah. Until it's done, you know?
Yeah.
But so Ethel ended up at a Swedish hospital. She met a woman from her hometown and she made that woman a dress. That woman happened to work for the Swedish consul's wife. And the diplomat's wife was so impressed that she ended up hiring her, saying, why would I travel to Paris when I can have custom-made clothing right in my own hometown? So that's crazy. She went from being in a camp to then like being a designer for the Swedish government's wife, you know. What a story. So then we go on to Romania, Russia, and the Ukraine. And their culture is kind of difficult to define because it was so entwined with the Soviet Union. But we do know that their food is very hearty.
I feel like we use that word a lot.
Yes. I feel like a lot of the food in this book is very hearty, which I guess...
Go ahead.
No.
I was going to say, when I heard the word hearty, it makes me think of that Dinty Moore beef stew that was like big back in the day.
So our story for this chapter is about Ellie Berkovitz Gross. Ellie Berkovitz Gross, who is from Romania. They were moved to an internment camp where she had to watch her brother wither away until he died. Which, that alone is sad. She was allowed to bring her family 2 potatoes every day because she worked, I think, in the factory with the potatoes. But that's it. They got 2 potatoes every day. And she said that she would just watch her brother every single day get smaller and smaller until he was gone. And then they were sent to Auschwitz after that. And despite getting sick, she was spared. And so she actually returned later to kind of the Auschwitz memorial and saw a photo of her mother and her brother and determined that she was going to be one of those people that never let anybody forget this tragedy.
Yeah.
So she now goes and speaks all over the world about it, which I think is pretty, pretty awesome. But again, she's one of those people that has people telling her that her experiences were fake.
So, ridiculous.
Yes. Agreed.
And how far-fetched they go with how all this was mm-hmm. faked. I'm like,
the mental gymnastics is completely insane.
This hate is all it is.
Yeah. So our final chapter is Greece. And people tend to forget that Greece was a part of the war because it is so far removed. Mm-hmm. But of the 43,000 Jews living in the region known as Salonika, 40,000 of them were killed. So only 3,000 survived, which is insane. But the food here, of course, is more Mediterranean, and it's not seen as traditionally Jewish. And so our story here is about Stella Levy. She was from a small island of Rhodes. She lived a really lovely childhood until the occupation came. She talked about how she, like, you know, went to school, she hung out with her friends, had a great time. And then the Italian government surrendered and gave Rhodes away. So then she was sent to Auschwitz from there. And she says that the end of Rhodes came in a manner so barbarous and cruel and inhumane that she still can't talk about it.
I mean, the Italians are... I mean, that was... Okay, so people know Hitler better.
Mm-hmm.
But Mussolini was like his mentor mm-hmm. for a while. Of course, he got a great ending. So his body dug up and his mistress is, you know, taken to the square. And
yeah.
Which I love when stuff like that happens to bad people.
Right.
I don't care if you think I'm bad for saying that. You know, whatever. Is it okay to talk about Auschwitz? Because people, as bad as it was, they were some really awful people.
Mm-hmm.
Bad people there. You know, one of them, Joseph Mengele. And he would do medical experiments.
Mm-hmm.
On the prisoners. Some of them would be testing different methods for mass sterilization.
Mm-hmm.
They would, it says, inflict wounds on prisoners or infect them with diseases. Which, I mean, our government did that, if you know about the Tuskegee experiment.
Yeah.
You know, people think our government's great. No, I mean, the CIA has pretty much admitted they killed Kennedy last week. So, and actually, 2 years ago, nobody paid attention to it then. Conducting unnecessary surgeries and procedures on patients just for research purposes.
Right.
I mean, I'm not going to go into detail about some of the horrible things they did. And Japan was doing this too with,
mm-hmm.
You know, GIs and prisoners from China, I think Korea too.
Yeah.
And then they would just murder and dissect prisoners.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there were some monsters. But the bad thing about this MF-er, he survives the war and goes to South America.
Yeah.
And lives, you know, until the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
He's a doctor.
Of course he is. Of course.
And that's why, you know, there was a show on the History Channel about, you know, finding Hitler. Because it's kind of, you know, sketchy about how, like, oh, yeah, the Russians got him, burned his body, here's a skull. And we're like, I need a little bit more than that.
Right.
But it's very plausible he did escape to Argentina or something.
Right.
Because they have, like, Nazi silverware. Mm-hmm. They have Nazi, you go down there and, hey, there's all these blonde hair, blue-eyed people walking around. So we know, I mean, obviously Mangala, but other not higher up Nazis escaped there. There was like compounds that remained, places for Hitler to go to. So, I mean, he very much could have survived. Yeah. But whether he did or not, it's bad enough that we let this guy survive.
Yeah.
And then you think about, well, we went to the moon. I think we did at least twice. I'm not going to get into that right now. But, I mean, Wernher von Braun, you know, created this V2 rockets firing into England. Then at the end of the war, he tried to say, you know, well, I didn't know that was happening. Buddy, you built a rocket.
Right.
Give me a break.
Yeah.
But we, you know, Project Paperclip. Russian got some scientists. We got some scientists. He was one of them. Mm-hmm. So, if, you know, you got to the moon because of a Nazi. You win the space race because of a Nazi.
Right. Yeah, I actually find the Argentinian thing. My husband and I were talking about that fairly recently, how a lot of Argentinians have started doing their DNA tests, and they're learning that they have Nazi Germany in their histories. And that's kind of, a fairly new understanding, is that so many of those Germans fled to Argentina for some reason.
At the same time, though, those people who are in Argentina now and they'd realize that. I really hope that the people around them and they themselves understand that they're not their ancestors.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, because I feel like that's important. Because I feel like we live in a society where everybody wants to judge people based on the people before them.
Right. Yeah.
So I hope that's the case down there.
Yeah. So, because this is a cookbook.
Yeah.
I went ahead and made one of the recipes before we got here, and I'm gonna go ahead and say it did not go as planned.
What?
We're gonna try it and see how it goes, but this one is on page 133.
Go ahead and get on up on that microphone.
It's 133. And it is Sabina Goldman's Bursting with Blueberries Tart. And so
there's a lot of blueberries. By the way, this picture looks more like it than I thought it, or I remembered it looking.
Yeah. So it's a picture on the front of the book, and I'm going to go ahead and just let you know that it's a little bit deceptive.
Hold on a second. We got to say this. We thought it was a blueberry pie, and we got mad last week. We were trying to get ready for this
episode. Because we couldn't find it. I was like, why would you put this picture on the front of the book?
It's a big A tart is what it is.
So Sabina says in her description, there are two kinds of blueberries. Those that are shy and drawn and not really worth eating, and those that are so ripe with blueberry flavor that they are ready to burst out of their skin. Those are the blueberries you want for the Simply Divine tart. I apparently did not use the right blueberries. So it's a little sour.
I mean, you didn't go to the grocery store and like look around for like those about to burst with flavor?
To try every single blueberry.
Yeah.
So the other thing about this recipe, it's a pretty simple recipe, in all honesty, but the filling, it calls for 4 cups of fresh blueberries, which I didn't use for all 4 cups. It was too much. 1/2 cup of sugar, 1/8 teaspoon of cinnamon, and then 2 tablespoons of flour. So I mixed all of that together, and then there's no like liquid ingredient here, so I just kind of dumped all of that into the pie and baked it. And I don't know if you've ever seen flour get baked without anything, but it doesn't really do anything. It just remains flour.
It might brown a little bit.
Just a little bit, yeah. And so when I pulled it out of the oven an hour later, there it was still just kind of white flour.
I got a text saying, hey, I want to be late. And I thought, okay, she'll be here in 30 minutes. And then this was like an hour later. Okay, I'm on my way. And it's because of that. I mean,
I had to like mix it up again and then rebake the whole thing.
But the cool thing is that you're actually experimenting with history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is something we like to do anyway.
Yeah.
But like, there is this, you know, Townsend's makes Revolutionary War, colonial era, early American clothing. And they have a great YouTube channel. And the guy who owns it, Robert Townsend, was Townsend's and Sons because his dad started it. He does historical cooking all the time on there. And some of them look great and some of them don't. There's early American YouTube channel. It's this engaged couple out in St. Genevieve, Missouri, and they do stuff like this, cooking in history. I think his name's Max Miller or something like that. Was that kind of channel? So we're actually doing kind of stuff. Well, you did stuff like that. So I'm kind of excited about it.
Yeah.
What else are we going to have?
So in the back of the book, and I want you guys to, well, it's afternoon now, so it's perfectly acceptable.
Well, as long as it's after 10. Before 10, you just do mimosas and Bloody Marys.
So this one, it's called The Drunken Pharaoh. And the description says, if you see Elijah when you open the door, you've had too much.
Wow, is he on a flaming chariot, like in the Bible?
Yes. So this one, it's a Jewish bourbon drink. And I told Johnny when I got here to film that the drink calls for one piece of matzo ball in each drink, kind of as a garnish.
Not hard no on that one.
I could not
do it.
I couldn't bring myself to make the matzo balls because the idea of putting a matzo ball in my bourbon did not
sit well. I wonder if that draws out the flavor or something, you know.
I don't know. Maybe I'll try it for a TikTok later and see how it goes. But we have matzo meal to put around the rim. So we're going to try both of those.
We're going to like salt margarita, but instead it's going to be this recipe.
Matzo, yep.
here's my question too, before we turn it off to get everything ready. And we're going to maybe try things separately. Like you'll go or either I'll go and we'll turn that mic off so people don't have to hear the chewing noise because I hate hearing that. But bourbon comes from Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Like, so did they like make this when they got to the U.S. or do they import bourbon?
So
otherwise, it's a whiskey. I mean, it's not. I know I'm being
so picky,
being picky about it, but
I don't have any internet at your house.
Doris Settles would probably like yell at me if I need to give you the password. So,
yep,
so I'm not gonna do it on the mic though.
You don't want to give everyone your password.
No.
So it calls for specifically Old Pogue bourbon. The Old Pogue distillery is in Maysville, Kentucky.
Yeah.
So you're right. I am not using Old Pogue today. I'm using what we have at home.
What did you have?
I don't know. Something with horses on it.
Are you sure it's actually bourbon?
Pretty sure. We bought it and based on the recommendation of some man who saw us standing there looking at all the bourbons trying to decide what to choose. He was like, that's a really good one. I like that one. And we're like, all right, good enough.
I hate when that happens. But I say that, but I've been that guy before. Like there was somebody looking for like weed killer or something in Lowe's. And I was like, hey, this is the one you want to go with because of blah, blah, blah. Then I'm like, they were just like, okay. And I was like, oh crap. It's one of those things that commercial don't be your parents.
Yeah. I was doing the same thing. All right. Should we pause?
We're going to pause. We're going to make everything. And we're going to drink while we work.
Yep.
Which
it's the best kind of work. Right.
Yeah. And we're going to submit a some, you know, see if they can reimburse us for it. Because you should. So, all right. We'll be right back. Okay. We are back. We've made the drinks. We got the tart. And well, I say we. I mean, Jenny made the drinks.
And the tart.
So I'm going to turn your mic off so people don't hear you.
You don't want to hear me chewing?
No, nobody likes that. Nobody wants to hear that. I have misophonia or whatever it's called. So, okay, here I go. I'm turning Jenny's mic off. All right, Jenny, go for it. You're staring at it a lot. Okay, now she's nodding, so I'm guessing it's good. All right, I'm going to turn your mic back on. How was it?
It's actually pretty good.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, I made it, so I'm a little biased, but like I said, the blueberries are a little tart. But other than that, it was pretty. I think it's good.
All right. You're going to have to talk. You're going to have to stretch it for me because I'm going to take a bite now.
So another weird thing about this recipe is that the crust called for 2 tablespoons of vinegar, which is interesting. He has to drink some water because it is tart.
It wasn't so much the tartness. It was the crust, which is the crust is really good too. This is really good.
Okay. Solid recipe.
I give it a 100%.
Nice.
You know what I mean? Like if I would like to have this, I would like to have this for breakfast. That's what I kind of am.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of lunch.
Well, yeah.
It's funny because my dad used to get mad at me because every once in a while I would eat. You know, he'd have like an apple pie and I would have apple pie with my eggs. And he would get mad, like, you can't eat that. I'm like, what's the difference between an apple pie and a Danish? They're the same thing, just in different forms.
People have breakfast all day long. My thing is, you can have ribs in the morning. You have nachos in the morning. You can have eggs at night. Whatever you want, whenever you want to have it, it's a free country. Go ahead, dig in.
All right, are you ready to try this drink? So I'm going to read the ingredients in this drink just so everybody is aware of what we are drinking. Since obviously this is a podcast.
I'm going to get some more tart while you do that.
So it's called the Drunken Pharaoh. For each drink, you need a piece of matzah, which again, I did not include today. Simple syrup, bourbon, lemon juice, and Manischewitz wine, and then club soda to top it off. And so to mix it, you put ice in the shaker glass, add the bourbon, lemon juice, and wine, shake it vigorously, and then strain it into the rimmed glass. And the rim on the glass is matzah crumbs and sugar. So that's going to be an interesting flavor combination that we may not enjoy.
One more thing about this. This is one of the best blueberry pie. I know it's a tart, but it's a pie to me. One of the best blueberry pies I've ever had. So compliments to you.
Thank you.
The only thing that would make it better is ice cream on top of it.
Yes, agreed. Agreed. I thought about that on my way here. I was like, should I stop?
It's not historically accurate.
Yeah. So not compliments to me, but compliments to, you know,
yeah,
our chef.
But you have to follow their recipes, too.
That's true. So. That's true. All right. Johnny, L'chaim. I'm nervous.
I'm so nervous. It does smell like chicken. It'll smell like chicken broth at the top. Because we rimmed the glasses. So.
It does smell like chicken broth.
It's like a meal and a drink. You know what? I think the matzo ball in it would have worked.
You think so?
Oh, yeah, 100%. That adds so much to the... It's already great.
Yeah. Surprisingly, it's actually pretty good.
That added so much to the flavor. I'm kind of mad we didn't do the matzo balls. Not mad, but
yeah,
maybe next time we'll do that.
Okay. Yeah, it's like the bourbon-y flavor isn't very strong. I think the wine, because it's like a fruit wine.
Yeah.
Kind of adds to it a lot.
Hey, you'll feel it though. Wow. that's really good. I mean, I would never have thought about that. Like, how did that come about to think about using matzah? And
yeah, that's surprisingly nice.
I love it.
All right, so.
Like, I would have that. I would order that.
Yeah.
If I was out somewhere. But yeah, so you going to close us out?
Yep. So, again, today's book is Food, Hope, and Resilience, Authentic Recipes and Remarkable Stories from the Holocaust Survivors by June Hirsch. This book is available anywhere books are sold and at arcadiapublishing.com. Definitely give us a follow for any other interesting stories that we're going to talk about in the future.
Yeah, and you can reach us by email, too. ArcadiaAuthorConversations@gmail.com. Should have made that simpler. I didn't. You're going to have to deal with it. Spell ArcadiaAuthorConversations@gmail.com. And it's all together. No spaces.
Yep. So until next time.
Yeah. We're done. See you guys later.